that Psalm?
Yeah. She was tired.
Yeah. So then it goes on. And then.
Thank you.
me get my sound on. When I'm ready to.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
Welcome to Zoom. Please press pound, then enter your meeting ID, followed by the pound sign again.
1 6 0 8 9 9 7.
Please enter the meeting passcode, followed by the pound sign.
Hi, Judge Calabresi, can you hear me? Hi, Judge, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can. Perfect. Give me 1 second.
Yeah,
Hello?
Yes. They're coming out in 1 second.
Okay. Natalie?
Yeah, they can hear me.
Yeah, they can hear me. They say they can hear me.
They can.
Could you call the inspector at the corner of Church and Chapel and see if they would be available to give me a pneumonia shot today?
Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this, a stated term of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, draw near, give your attention, ye shall be heard.
Thank you. Please be seated. Everyone. So we're ready for our first case for argument, and you will see, of course, we have Judge Calabresi with us via Zoom.
And good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, and so our first case for argument is Esther Solomon v. Fordham University Administration et al. And so, Ms. Solomon, you have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, and so you have 7 minutes now. So whenever you are ready, you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Esther Solomon. Can you hear me? I'm okay?
Yes.
My name is Esther Solomon, the pro se appellant in this employment discrimination and retaliation case. My professional livelihood and 35-year career as a tenured professor and multiple-term faculty senator representing the business school have been destroyed because of discrimination, the creation of intolerable academic working conditions, gender-based disparate pay, and constructive discharge. Fordham's actions culminated in my secret termination as a tenured professor on February 1st, 2020, without cause or due process. Multiple retaliatory actions ensued after I filed this lawsuit. As of the spring 2018 semester adverse action, I was transferred and demoted from graduate business school professor to teach elementary courses. There's a static
feedback, yeah.
Sorry. Should I stop?
That's okay, yeah.
Okay. These diminished responsibilities, an excessive and disproportionate workload, interference with my research, and disparate treatment became the sine qua non of my assignments ever since. This demotion was not visited upon the males or younger females. Over the years,
Ms.
Fordham had used similar methods to force the resignation or retirement of other protected class professors.
Yes. Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to ask you, I mean, part of what you have to establish with regard to a hostile work environment claim is that the incidents that you're talking about interfered with your ability to do your work. So could you address impacted your ability to do your work specifically?
By demoting me from the graduate school to the undergraduate, a very, very busy schedule, there was not enough time for me to do my research. And the requirements for professors are the three core characteristics of teaching, research, and service. And those, all three were impacted by this hostile work environment. Also, as I have alleged in my complaint, there has been a longstanding pattern in which the same There is a longstanding pattern in which the same group of male management area chair had acted to undermine my career for years, including the time after the...
I have a question with respect to that. The lower court held that many things that happened for 2017 were barred by statute of limitations. On the other hand, our cases say that things that happened...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I couldn't hear you very well. I didn't hear.
Okay, let me try again.
Okay.
The lower court held that many things that happened before 2017 were barred by the statute of limitations. That's a question. But assuming that it is right, our cases say that what happens before may be relevant to understanding what happens after. So I'm asking to see whether some of the things that happened before 2017 were such so that we would understand what happened afterwards as creating a hostile work environment.
Thank you, Your Honor. As you correctly stated, Davis Garrett, events that occur before the 300 days, if they're part of the same pattern of unlawful activities, they can be considered. At the minimum, they can be considered as context. But in this situation, it is part the same actors and the same type of activities interfering with my career and, in fact, replacing me. The same individuals did this to me. They did it to others as well. So the same male supervisors with administrative acting jointly took egregious actions over years to the point that in 2016, me and another female senator who were doing our job representing the business school and trying to oppose statutory violations were punished, retaliated in public, and the faculty senate had to intervene, and they issued their anti-retaliation resolution to protect the two female senators. Also, the board of trustees intervened to stop that time. That was one of several actions that were taken to undermine mine and other female leadership abilities and to remove them from leadership positions that were duly elected and duly occupied. And it was always done in violation of procedures, statutes, and denial of hearing. And the same thing happened afterwards. The termination without cause or due process after I had requested the university president specifically because they warned me they would cut my benefits, I went to the university president and asked him, wrote him in letter 22A, I believe is the exhibit, and I requested a hearing and not a due process. So there's a pattern.
Excuse me. So you are saying that we should understand what was... after 2017 or whatever the date is, in the light of things which were done that were similar before.
Yes. The same pattern, and again, a pattern of pervasive avoidance of due process, avoidance of review, false charges, and this was not just me, it was many professors who suffered similar fate. They were trying to force them out and get them to resign by these egregious actions. I don't remember exactly where I stopped, but I will continue about that. Over the years, Fordham had used similar methods to force the resignation or retirement of other protected class professors. They targeted them through transfer to elementary undergraduate teaching and humiliating demotion. A senior professor who was forced out wrote, "Thank you for your concerns. Yes, I am not coming back. I have been exposed to concerted efforts of the new regime to push me out. I have been requested to teach undergraduate basic statistics and criticize for some snow days I missed due to illness. They stopped my salary already. Now I have to get some health insurance, and then I will fight for my retirement income." That is in JA 95, paragraph 317.
Okay.
This was the blueprint for what I would soon face. Yes.
Yes. No, I know. It's a little multiple sources of question. So you come to the end of your time. You'll still have a few moments, three minutes afterwards. So if you can wrap up and we'll go to hear from your adversary. So.
Okay. I also experienced severe gender-based pay discrimination as a professor since my salary had been approximately 50% compared to the salaries of other professors. And my salary was about $115,000. The professor's average was $211,000. And this was comparison with other eight male faculty comparators at the business school, okay. Comparative to which the university agreed and on which they produced this. And therefore, they cannot dispute their eligibility as comparators.
Okay, I think we have your
thank
position.
You so much.
Yes, thank you. McLaughlin?
Yes.
All right, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court. Jennifer McLaughlin of Cullen and Dykeman LLP for Fordham University.
Could you speak close to the mic, sure. If you can?
Thank it's better?
You. Yeah.
Appellant must nudge her claims across the line from conceivable to plausible to proceed in this lawsuit sounding in discrimination. Afforded three times by the district court to amend her pleading, her own statements in her voluminous submissions undercut plausibility, and as such, the district court's orders should be affirmed. I'd like to address briefly certain aspects of appellant's disparate treatment claim, her equal pay claim, and retaliation claims.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about the pay claim, please, because the table that she adduces shows a pretty dramatic differential between the male purported comparators and her own pay scale over a period of time.
Sure. The Equal Pay Act, as we all know, prohibits employers from discriminating among employees on the basis of sex by paying higher wages to employees of the opposite sex for equal work. Appellant states that her compensation is far lower than other male faculty. But what she failed to allege in any of her pleadings that the job content of the other male faculty, who she contends are paid more in that chart, are equivalent to hers. As stated in her pleading.
Counsel, this is 12B6. We have said that at summary judgment, there has to be a fair sign that the things are the same, and often that's a jury question. But isn't it premature for such a thing to be decided at 12B6 when she could come in with evidence that shows that vote titles and things are somewhat different, but basically these people are valid comparators. Haven't we done that in any number of cases?
Well, Your Honor, I point you to the case of EEOC versus the Port of Authority. In that case, there was a failure to allege any facts concerning the attorneys in the Port Authority's law department's actual job duties, deprived this court from which to draw a reasonable inference that the attorneys performed equal work, the touchstone of an EPA claim. Similarly here, in that case, this court said attorneys are attorneys is not sufficient. Similarly here, professors are professors is not sufficient. As stated in her pleadings, there's a very wide range of responsibilities professors have according to the Fordham faculty statutes, some of which include research obligations, other opportunities outside of their teaching roles in administration. There is no comparator that she's pointed to similarly situated to her that is being paid more and outside of a protected class.
Am I right in understanding that initially, the district court has seen this, I think, four times, and after its first decision, it allowed discovery to proceed for some period of time. Is that right? Pending
right.
Amendment of the complaint and so on. And Ms. Solomon, Professor Solomon, had the assistance of counsel at that time. Fordham produced documents and responded to interrogatories, giving Ms. Solomon an opportunity to develop facts that would be relevant to the status of the comparators. Is that right?
Correct. And then she developed the chart that you were referring to earlier today, again, without giving any inkling in her pleading as to who among those male professors were similarly situated to her.
Wasn't there an issue with regard to the information that was provided didn't fully disclose the salaries for specific professors or specific positions? I mean, isn't that a little bit of a hindrance to fully fleshing out the comparators?
Well, I believe the information, there was some information redacted in terms of names and other information that wouldn't necessarily show either way in terms of whether or not they were comparators. I think the information given was sufficient to provide her an opportunity. And again, it's the male comparators in her department, which I think there are 16 of them or so, to determine whether or not there's somebody similarly situated to her that she could point to that are paid more for those reasons that she states in her complaint.
Counsel, I have another question. That is, the district court said that all sorts of things that happened before a certain date were irrelevant, were beyond the statute of limitations. And she argues that's continuous. The district court has good arguments for why they're not. But the district court then specifically failed to take those into account in understanding her claims. Now, that is on its face error under our cases. And so I'd like you to address why, if there was that error isn't by itself reason enough to send it back. That is, if the district court looked at things post-2017 without considering the effect of the earlier ones, as our cases say, shouldn't we send it back, or is there reason not to?
Well, the items that were mentioned in the pleadings outside the statute of limitation in connection with her hostile work environment claim included the nomination denial of a chair position.
Counsel. Yes. Talking not just of hostile work environment.
Right.
I'm talking about real cases. But I'm talking also about whether actions were sufficient, discriminatory, whether the whole smear.
Right. But I think the claims that she raises outside of the statute of limitations, such as denial of a chair position in 2013, if that was based on discrimination, it should have been raised and challenged then. And also her other allegations of items or actions that happened to her outside of the statute of limitations related to failure to schedule meetings or including her in them. Again, inside the statute of limitations, she talks about being personally attacked or abruptly being cut off in meetings. All of these items, I think the district court recognized, could give context to the discrimination claim, but didn't necessarily, again, push it over the line to plausible to support or withstand, I should say, the 12B6 motion.
I have yet another question. Somewhere in your argument, you make the rather remarkable statement that it is settled law that things which she claims are not sufficient to be adverse actions. And for that item, you cite a district court that cites a summary order, which is not really in point. Now, that's a remarkable way of saying it's settled action of our court, when many cases in our courts have suggested that things analogous to this were adverse actions, at least at a 12B6. Now, I'd like you to address that, because I was very troubled by that in your brief, I must say.
So, if you're referring to the Klein case of the Southern District, in which the court analyzed teaching schedules and whether affording a teacher or a professor an undergraduate course versus a PhD course was adverse.
I am troubled by your telling us that it is settled law of our circuit, and then citing a district court that cites a summary order, which isn't really important anyway.
Understood.
I mean, that's...
Understood, Your Honor. But again, I believe that the adverse employment action argument that the court below did find that could be...
Do you have a better case from our court to support what you're saying?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the edge of that.
Do you have a case from our court to support that statement? Leave aside that the citation ain't any very good, but do you have cases?
In terms of a professor and their teaching schedule and whether or not it's onerous, there is the Vega case versus Hempstead that also talks about whether there's an onerous assignment, and that was related to a discrimination matter on a 12B6 motion. And in that case, in the Vega case, the professor or teacher there, I believe in a high school, was given a certain assignment based on his Hispanic national origin. He was given all the Spanish students. He was asked to transfer to a different school. And that, Your Honor, again, distinguished from this, was considered onerous by that court.
Your strongest arguments, frankly, I think, are that everything that was done with respect to the appellant was done not for reasons of discrimination, but because the school found her troublesome, that they didn't get along. And that may well be a winning argument, but is that an argument that should be done at this stage?
Again, as you say, I don't believe that this is a case of discrimination, and that, as you've mentioned, this may have been a disagreement as to course assignment and position within the university. But
or even a personal dislike, which, you know, may not be nice or may be nice, but it's not a matter of federal law.
Exactly. And for that reason, Your Honor, I believe that she hasn't stated a case of discrimination. She may have stated a case of not getting along with her fellow colleagues. I see my time has run, and if there's further questions, or okay. If not, I would rest on the brief.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I would like to correct the record regarding what the Fordham representative indicated. I will start with the end, with the adverse action. The district court did find adverse action per the Vega case, that my case, contrary to the Klein case which the university cites, demonstrates that the assignments were more onerous, that there was it interfered with my research, and that it was adverse employment action. And that fulfilled the third of the four requirements for a discrimination case. Also, I have very strong indicators of discriminatory intent, extraordinary, I believe, which demonstrate, have proven my case that I had a discrimination case that was plausibly alleged. And per my brief, the adverse actions are the following. First of all, the plaintiff's demotion and transfer as of spring 2018 per Vega, unlike the male and younger females. Number two, the disparate pay, about half of the comparators, and exclusion of older females from administrative and teaching opportunities. Number three, the persistence of the demotion following semester after semester, reflecting an intention to force me out and constructive discharge. Then workplace sabotage when I return post-termination, in which I was cut off from the blackboard, and I was precluded from teaching, demonstrating the intent to force me out even after the termination. And of course, the fifth adverse employment action is the termination, which is the ultimate adverse action, which is documented in Fordham submission to the IRS and the Department of Labor through the COBRA regulations. So in addition to the termination, there was there a report pursuant to federal law that is permanent part of my record, and it has never been removed as of February 1st, 2020. I would also like to mention regarding the procedural issues that Your Honor mentioned previously, that the discovery that took place here was way before the first order. Initially, in 2019, when I was pro se, through the pro se office, they brought me in contact with a Cravet firm, and there was discovered for about 2 months. That's all the discovery that took place. After the firm left, there were, in my view, there were too many obstacles. I used this material subsequently, but I was denied any discovery as of I believe it was April 2019. There was absolutely nothing. Then I submitted some subpoenas because I was missing information. They had redacted, contrary to a protective order, all the names of the professors. So as you see, the judge actually commented there are no names because I didn't have them. So I had subpoenas for my my own personnel records, which were deficient, and for those of the comparators. And there was this hearing in January 29, and that hearing was because I requested the court to allow me for a motion to compel discovery. And the court allowed me, and I submitted this motion, but this motion was never reviewed, and it is a footnote in the judge's first order that he stopped discovery, and I have nothing ever since, and that was as of very early 2020. So the only discovery was 2 months in 2019 before the first report of termination. As you probably know, there were two reports of termination that the Fordham filed.
Thank you.
And one last thing is about the comparators. I wanted to point out that in my motion for reconsideration, I had attached a very important, I think, decision by Fred in the Ninth Circuit, which specifically addressed the issue of comparator professors in universities. And what the Fried case, it was a summary judgment case, but I believe this is applicable to the Second Circuit, although the court indicated that it might not be. What the Fried decision said is that professors' jobs consist of teaching, research, and service, and that is sufficient. And I supported that with sections from the university statutes that define the duties of faculty, the research, the service duties, the criteria, and also I addressed the standards in the Second Circuit that said that there should be equal standards, and I defined the standards for professors, everything according to the university statutes.
Okay.
There was also an AUP. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I think we understand your position, so
okay.
We'll
okay.
conclude
thank
that.
You. Thank,
okay,
you.
Thank you. Thank you. And you can have a seat. And so we'll have a brief recess now. We'll be right back.
Court stands in recess.
Okay, cut me off.
Will do, Judge. Have a great day.
Your cases. Thank you. judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit.
All right. Thank you. Please be seated. All right. Thank you. So we will continue with our calendar. All right. All right. So the next case for argument is Magalhaes v. Peralta. And Mr. Greenberg, you've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Judge Lee, Judge Chin, Judge Carney, I represent the three defendants who are correctional officers in this case, Matthew Peralta, Timothy Bailey, and Edward Blunt. As the court knows, this is a 1983 action in which the plaintiff alleges excessive force and failure to intervene. You also know as well this trial in this case was a pure credibility contest. The plaintiff testified to an alleged assault. The three defendants denied any such assault ever occurred. A fourth correction officer, not a defendant, but who was also present during the alleged event, likewise testified it never happened. I think in order to understand the extraordinary, and I do mean extraordinary, set of events on the third day of the trial, April 28th, that led to, respectfully, error after error after error by the district court, to understand that and to understand how an experienced district court judge could make such errors, is to understand this trial was conducted in April of 2021, shortly after the Southern District reopened its courts in the midst of COVID. You see it, for example, on page 51 of the record. Judge Halper actually watched jury selection to see how it was done. Plexiglass, social distancing. My clients sat all the way in the back of the courtroom, could not sit with their lawyer because they had to communicate via text. Why do I tell you all of that? Because even the most experienced district court judge would have their hands filled coping in that environment. But on April 28th, for example, I believe the judge and parties saw something they probably never heard or saw in a courtroom before. Plaintiff's counsel came in and said, hot off the presses, my next witness, we're in plaintiff's case in chief, just had his life threatened by someone outside in the hallway. A person, by the way, the record is crystal clear, had no connection to the defendants, no connection to plaintiff. Now, this court has had case after case after case involving death threat evidence. There is a vast body of case law involving death threat evidence. It's settled and it's crystal clear. All of those cases involve circumstances where the death threat is coming into that courtroom and everyone knows it months in advance. There are motions in limine, the court has briefing and arguments.
Was there an objection made to the testimony about the death threat?
There was no opportunity, Judge Chin, to have an objection. Page 567 of the record. The moment Judge Sabol hears that there was a death threat in the hallway, she says, I quote, page 567, first of all, obviously it's fair game for you to ask this witness on the stand if it happened. Later on the next page, but if it's true, she says to plaintiff's counsel, it will help your case. Rule 46, Judge Chin, makes crystal clear that there is no obligation to make an objection when there is no opportunity to raise it before the ruling.
There was an opportunity. Was there an objection at the time of the testimony? There wasn't an objection then, was there?
The judge ruled the moment she heard there was the death threat. She said, if I might, obviously fair game. The only thing that's obvious under your cases, the only
thing.
Why
couldn't counsel say that it's not obvious, Your Honor?
Well, because, Your Honor, in this context, something no one in this courtroom, I respectfully submit, had ever seen, No one had the opportunity to run back and see the vast literature. I've been practicing law for 30 years, Judge Kent. I had no idea what the body of law...
But isn't it just... I mean, certainly things happen at trial, and counsel may not be in a position to cite case law, but if a ruling is being made that is harmful, to say to the judge, well, Judge, I don't agree with that, or I think this might be a problem, there was nothing like that, was there?
There was a motion for a mistrial that came shortly after this, when after the death threat testimony was heard by the jurors, as you would expect, a juror came forward, said they were fearful for their life, connected the dots, attributed to the defendants.
But that's a separate, the mistrial didn't relate to the death threat testimony. The mistrial was with regard to the jurors' comments, wasn't it?
In response to the death threat testimony. But respectfully, even if you want to use plain error review, this is the plainest error you might ever see. Why? The judge says, obviously fair game. Here's what's obvious. There is not a case that I have been able to find ever decided in the Second Circuit when death threat testimony was admitted where there was no connection to either of the parties. Why is there no case that allows that? Because, and I
cited... What about the district court's instruction later, pointing out that there was nothing to associate the death threat to any of the defendants? Didn't that mitigate any prejudice?
Judge Shin, I am so glad you asked. The curative instruction was given. The juror then came before the judge after the curative injunction, after the instruction, and connected the dots and attributed it to the defendants. This court has acknowledged...
I'm sorry.
Please.
Attributed to the defendants? What in the record suggests... I mean, when the juror came forward, he's expressing concern, but what suggests that he is attributing the threats to the defendants?
The juror in this case, Your Honor, indicated on page... we're in 659 to 662, said he connected the dots, and obviously it was intended to favor the defendants, causing Judge Sabo to say, well, no...
So you're basing that he's... Connecting the dots, you read that as him saying, oh, the threats are coming from the defendants, even though the court has instructed the jury that that's not the case? Is that your position?
No, my position is, in response to Judge Chin's question, the curative instruction cannot unring the bell when you're dealing with death threat testimony. Judge Jacobs in the Morgan case, this court again and again, I can't emphasize enough, I cannot find a case when death threat testimony ever was in when there's no connection to the parties. Why? Because it is the paradigmatic example of toxic evidence. Any experienced trial lawyer who knew that testimony was coming in, death threat testimony, right outside the hallway, case over. Case over. Plaintiff would have no, defendants would have no chance. Let me give you another example of...
So you're saying there's nothing the district court could have done to cure the prejudice? That prejudice was paramount and obvious, and there is no way to cure it, despite the fact that objections weren't made at the time and the ambiguity of the juror's statement and so on, that the game was over.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it's clear when you see this wasn't the death threat testimony.
Did she offer to strike the testimony?
She did. She did. That was her first instinct, because the second era, for the first time in Second Circuit history, a judge allowed death threat testimony as an anticipatory impeachment device. There's no case law in the Second Circuit. Other circuits have addressed it. Allowing testimony...
I don't know that you can say it's only the second time in Second Circuit history. I mean, it could have happened and there was no opinion written on it.
You're right, Judge Shin. What I'm saying is I cannot find a case, and I don't believe there is one, when a court allowed, in the plaintiff's case in chief, death threat testimony in order to impeach a witness in the defendant's case in chief, and those circuits that have addressed it have said it's disfavored. Why is it disfavored? It's disfavored because the witness might not testify, and the testimony would prove to be irrelevant, which is to your point, Judge Chen. That's why when the judge heard, oh my goodness, the death threat testimony, she's not going to testify. It's no use. She said, I'm going to strike it. Plaintiff's counsel then said no, in words or substance, it wouldn't be fair, the courage this child, the plaintiff had, the witness had to testify. And then they cooked up a post hoc rationale to allow the testimony. What was the post hoc rationale? Oh, state of mind. All of that is wrong. And the other thing I would sort of say, another example of it, is the linchpin witness, the critical witness, the witness who plaintiff testified about extensively, who plaintiff's counsel in opening statement talked about again and again and again, the eyewitness to the alleged events, plaintiff's wife, Lisa Magalios, Lisa Tibaldi, at the time of the trial.
You say that this was essentially a credibility case, or entirely a credibility case, but there was the medical evidence, and there was testimony about an imprint of a boot on his back.
That
seems more objective evidence.
Well, the proffer made by defendant's trial counsel in this case was the witness was going to say she did hear from the plaintiff, and she was told by the plaintiff that he was beaten by a incarcerated
individual. I understand
that,
but, well, she was going to say that, apparently contradicting what she had testified to under oath at deposition. Now, is there any other evidence anywhere that an inmate assaulted the plaintiff? Do inmates wear boots? I don't know that there's any evidence to support the theory that an inmate beat him up.
I think the court can take judicial notice that incarcerated individuals get into fights, and yes, there is violence between incarcerated individuals. But the point is,
there's no report of such an attack. There's no incident report about an inmate attacking him. In other words, it just there does seem to be evidence to support the plaintiff's side of it.
The jury, Your Honor, was denied the testimony of the person who plaintiff, in the opening statement and in his testimony, said was there, testified extensively about her reactions. She was there.
Well, she wasn't there at the assault. She wasn't. She was in the facility, but she was not there for the assault.
She was there for the linchpin event that allegedly triggers the assault. In the visiting room, she was present. She, according to plaintiff who testified about it, and even what her emotions were, they embraced and hugged, and one of the correction officers, not any of the defendants, said, "Stop that," used profanity, and that was allegedly the triggering event that would motivate three correction officers to put their lives, career, and livelihood in jeopardy by assaulting the plaintiff. That's her. She is right there. She is the witness, and I respectfully urge the court, look at the opening statement. Look at plaintiff's testimony. She was going to testify, and yet the judge, again, in a COVID-like environment, like that, without giving anyone the opportunity to object, because she said what she was going to tell the witness. She said she was going to tell the witness, "You may incriminate yourself. You have a right to consult a lawyer." Unobjectionable. No one would object to that. No one would. Why? Nothing's wrong with that. But then look at what the witness was actually told by Judge Sabol. She was told, not once, not twice, three times, "You have a constitutional right to refuse to testify."
But your position is that she had no constitutional right anymore, because she had waived her right. Right, that she had no privilege, and that by having given testimony about this earlier, she opened the door to questions under oath as to any aspect of it. And that's a position I don't understand, because the crime at issue with regard to the judge's instruction was the crime of perjury. She had not testified, and she testified as to other events, but she is not at risk of perjury in her early testimony. Maybe you could explain what I'm missing.
Yes, Judge Carney. And Judge Sabol told her.
Sybel.
Sybel.
Forgive me, Judge. Told her it was a crime. It was illegal. You, Ms. Tibaldi, could be convicted.
To testify falsely. And
correct.
She had not testified as to the prior inquiry in her sworn statements was as to this event, not as to what was not later proffered, that she was going to testify contrary to what she had said before under oath. So isn't that a different concern that would require a lawyer? She wasn't at risk of being prosecuted for giving an account initially as to an event, a beating, in which she had no participatory role.
I understood that the admonishment was that if you testify differently, it's the first sentence in the
evidence. Yes, yes.
If you testify differently, you may incriminate yourself by testifying falsely. I think the word falsely was
yes.
used. My point just about that, though, that was contrary to several circuits' decisions, incorrect instruction that she had a right to refuse to testify. Incorrect. Other circuits have addressed the issue under the same proceeding rule. If you testify at a deposition, you cannot invoke a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to testify at the trial. Error one. Error two, you don't even have to reach that. What other circuits and virtually a uniform body of federal case law hold with respect to the waiver issue. Error two, you set forth the two-prong test in Klein as to how you determine whether or not there is a waiver of a Fifth Amendment privilege. The judge below
all the case,
did not...
All the cases I looked at that you've cited have to do with refusing to testify as to the matters, that the substance of the matters that the person had originally testified as to.
Yes.
Here, there was a different crime at issue as to which one might need counsel, which is that she was going to give testimony, presumably contrary to what she had testified under oath before.
Yes.
So she did not need counsel necessarily in the first because she was not charged with any crime. She had not done the beating. And later on, if she was going to testify separately, I don't understand why it was improper to advise her that testifying, that she was opening herself up to a perjury charge by testifying inconsistently with her initial statements. Maybe one of my colleagues can explain it better than I am, but I'm having difficulty understanding. Your position seems to be that once you've testified, you can as to an event, you may always be forced to testify as to that event, regardless
yes.
if you're taking a separate position later about what happened.
Our position and the position of other circuits is that if you, in a single case, in a deposition, testify to A, B, C, and D, you cannot invoke a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to testify at the trial about A, B, C, D. You have waived that right.
So she had to be put on the stand and questioned. She had to answer those questions. And if she answered them in a way that your clients didn't like, then so
absolutely.
Be it.
They would have
and
had
if
to.
She, and if she answered them in a way consistent with the proffer of counsel, perjuring herself, then so be it.
Yes, Your Honor.
That explains it.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
I do have some rebuttal. Thank you for your indulgence on that. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Mr. Is it Sivan?
Thank you, Your Honors. Edward Sivan for the appellee. Can I get 1 minute on my cross appeal rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. What is fatal to the appellant's argument that they were denied the right to call Lisa Tobaldi is that they chose not to call Lisa Tobaldi. After this discussion about the Fifth Amendment and counsel announced to the court she doesn't want to testify, Judge Seibel stated, and I quote on page 606, quote, "You can still call her. She's here." They chose not to call her. They can't now turn around and say we were deprived of the right to call her. Nor can they say that they were deprived of an opportunity to object. They had several opportunities. Beginning on page...
Well, I think their position is that the court improperly intimidated, swayed, what have you, Ms. Tobaldi into not testifying, that that's what the problem is from their
point
of view.
But if you look at the court's instruction, it was very benign compared to what other cases have held is intimidation. The court said to Ms. Tobaldi, among other things. I'm not suggesting that any prosecutor would have any interest in your case or that any prosecutor would prosecute you for lying under oath, but you need to be informed that it is a possibility and that lying under oath is illegal, and that if your testimony would be that you previously lied under oath, you would be incriminating yourself, and you have a right under the Fifth Amendment not to do that. And I encourage you to consult with counsel. Not only was it not improper for the judge to do that, but I think had the judge just said, you know, let's throw her to the lions, let her go in and testify and perjure herself, that would have been error. And with respect to the Klein case, which is the seminal case by this circuit, regarding what type of statements are incriminatory, on page 288 of the Klein case, this court stated that the statements must have been made under oath, which they were at the deposition, and they must be, quote, incriminating, meaning that they did not merely deal with matters collateral to the events surrounding the commission of the crime, and here there was no crime to which Lisa Tibaldi potentially could be involved. The only potential crime was the officers, but directly inculpated the witness on the charge at issue. There was nothing that inculpated Lisa Tibaldi on the charges at issue when she testified to what her ex-husband told her.
It is troubling that the evidence came in for a certain purpose, and then it turned out she didn't testify, and so there is this evidence of a death threat. And Judge Seibel's first instinct was to strike it, but was it you who tried it, or
no? It was with my partner.
One of your partner objected, and it stayed in. When it would have been cleaner just to strike it.
Well, it was number one. It was relevant to the issue of the witness's state of mind, which cases have said can be inappropriate. The judge who was sitting there.
And nobody, what does that mean? How was his state of mind relevant? He looked nervous, anxious.
Well, according to the judge, he looked freaked out. Now, a jury could possibly interpret his being freaked out as, is he lying on the witness stand? Or maybe he's freaked out because somebody just threatened his life. But again, defense counsel had an opportunity to object to that. In fact, on page 607, the court said, well, I guess what I could do is say it's only to be considered for what effect it might have on his state of mind, because although he warmed up as he went along, he clearly was nervous at first, so I think you're right. I think it's perhaps relevant to explain why he was a little freaked out at first, but I'll make sure that the jury understands there's nothing about the threat that should be holding against either side. Seem fair? Mr. Miller, my partner, said, I think that's fair compromise. And then Ms. Costa Pettyjohn for the defense said, thank you, Your Honor. Not, Your Honor, that's not right. You should not give that instruction. She acquiesced and said, thank you, Your Honor. If I can turn briefly to the issue of punitive damages. There's no one in a better position than the trial court to make a determination as to the reasonableness of a jury's award on punitive damages. Here there was an unprovoked, premeditated.
If that's true, what about your cross appeal?
That's also.
You're in a sort of a difficult position here. Reasonable with respect to it being not too high, but unreasonable in that it is too low, the awards? That's kind of what you're arguing.
I'm not sure I understand, Your Honor.
It's okay. It's not artfully formed. Go ahead.
Okay. But in any event, the judge who sat through this trial and the jury was entitled to conclude not only that these officers engaged in this vicious, premeditated attack, but that the day after the attack, when they were questioned by their supervisor, denied that anything happened. One of them even said, I don't even remember anything about yesterday or who I was working with. The jury and the judge were also entitled to find that the defendants lied on the stand about the incident. And not only did they not show any remorse at the trial, but they showed contempt for the court and for the plaintiff by laughing during the proceedings, and in the case of one of the defendants, Officer Blount, beginning his testimony on the witness stand by hurling a profanity at Mr. Magalhaes. It's no wonder that the court, under these circumstances, concluded the jury's award doesn't shock my conscience, but the court felt constrained by this court, by what it viewed as the precedent of this court, to reduce the jury's award.
Is it clear, though, that the judge was acting out of a sense of, I mean, certainly there was the comment about this doesn't shock my conscience, but there was a lot of grappling with considering the appropriate factors and the ratios and all of that. I mean, it didn't, I did not get the impression that the judge felt, well, I have to make this determination on the amount. I had the impression that the judge was considering all these factors and said, this is what seems to be appropriate. And, you know, given, to take another version of what Judge Chin was suggesting, given your recognition that the judge did see the testimony, was present for all this, has the best sense of the case, what reason is there to find that the number that she landed on was an abuse of discretion?
Because I think the judge misinterpreted Second Circuit precedent by putting too much emphasis on the ratio between compensatory damages and punitive damages. The most important factor in punitive damages, as the courts have held over and over again, is the egregiousness of the conduct. And the court agreed this was really, really egregious. Not only was their conduct egregious at the time, but continuing all throughout the case and into the courtroom. Having come to that conclusion, I think it was error for the court to then determine that it was not permitted to uphold the jury's award on punitive damages. And in our cross appeal, we're respectfully asking this court to announce that the facts of this case, under the facts of this case, it would not have been an abuse of discretion for the court to abide by its conscience, and that in fact it was error for the court to disregard its conscience.
So you're saying basically it was a legal error in how she weighed the factors?
Yes. Unless the court has anything else for me, I'm going to rest on my brief.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Just a few quick rebuttal points. With respect to the admonitions given by the district court to Ms. DeBaldi, Judge Carney, you understood our argument exactly right. No sentient person, let alone a lay person who received warnings like that, you can refuse to testify. You can refuse to testify. You can refuse to testify. Would testify under those circumstances.
But you couldn't have called her. Correct? Your adversary says you could have called her. Is that correct?
To his second point, could have called her. This is after the death threat evidence comes in which the death threat evidence says it's her boyfriend, right? So that would be the plaintiff. Defendants would have called her so she could take the fifth over and over and over again and then be impeached on the death threat evidence. With all respect, Your Honor, that was not even a theoretical proposition. It would have amounted to nothing more than preserving some kind of argument for this court.
So your colleague on the other side points out the colloquy at pages 607 and 608. Judge Seibel says, seem fair. And the defense counsel says, thank you, Your Honor. Defense counsel could have said, that's not fair. I object or propose something different.
What defense counsel was facing, Judge Chin, is when the judge first heard about this, she said, obviously fair game. A district court judge is telling you, obviously fair game.
Judge Seibel made a proposal as to how to handle this, asked both sides if it seemed fair. Plaintiff's side said, I think that's a fair compromise. And the defense side said, thank you, Your Honor. I mean, what is Judge Seibel supposed to do with that?
I believe what Judge Seibel should have done the moment she heard that there was death threat.
Oh, I understand that yes. you go back to the earlier point then. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the death threat testimony, Opposing counsel says it was relevant, and Judge Chang, you were asking questions about it. It's relevant. That's not the law. This court in the United States versus Morgan said, not relevance, there must be a showing that the evidence serves an important purpose and is clearly needed. This much is clear. This much isn't debatable. This death threat evidence, right, notwithstanding objections, preservation, was clearly error to come in. And had there been an objection contemporaneously after the court, what did it, you're not objecting to testimony being adduced, you're objecting to a court who has ruled, clearly obvious, that would be error. Finally, with respect to their claim that somehow or other the punitive damages, which in this case assessed against three correction officers who were state employees in the amount of $500,000, right, is somehow not sufficient. First of all, it's clearly, I would suggest under your precedent, excessive. This court would conduct infinitely worse, and I'm not diminishing the conduct here, the alleged conduct, right? I'm not diminishing it. You have had cases with people beaten with batons, handcuffed, rendered unconscious, and remitted the punitive damage awards to amounts less than this.
And the jury awarded $950 total?
$50,000. That was the award, which gets us to...
But the punitives?
The punitives, the jury awarded $1 million. If memory serves, $350,000,
$350,000.
And $250,000. And the court below essentially halved that. But the argument, I think, on the cross appeal is that somehow or other too much emphasis was given on the second Gore factor, comparing the compensatory award to ratio. No, it wasn't. You've spoken to that issue in your decision in Turley, where you held in a case where the compensatory awards is substantial, $50,000 is substantial for three correction officers, and the punitive award is stacked up on top of it, and both awards amount to visceral pain and suffering kinds of damages. Here there were no lost medical bills. There was no inability to go to work or any of that. It was pain and suffering. When you stack that up, then you can look at ratios, and this court has said a 4-to-1 ratio treads on thin ice constitutionally. Well, that's essentially what the court below ended up awarding. The $200,000 was 4-to-1, 4-to-1. And the final thing I'll say with respect to Mr. Blunt, who is not alleged to have been actively involved in the assault, the claim is that he failed to intervene. Under your precedence, a $100,000 punitive award, and I'm not trying to diminish the alleged conduct, is wildly excessive for someone who's alleged merely to have observed and not acted. So for all of the reasons in our briefs and my argument, we respectfully request that you reverse and order a new trial in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just very briefly on the issue of punitive damages, I don't think it's useful to limit the discussion to talk about whether it was he was kicked or whether he was hit by a baton. I think what's more important in this case is that this was not an instance of officers overreacting and then afterwards saying, okay, maybe I overreacted. This was an instance of the officers then covering it up and then fabricating statements about it, coming to court, laughing, snickering, and doing everything to avoid any type of responsibility, showing no remorse but only showing contempt. And that's a factor that aggravates this case and that should sustain the jury's original award. Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. Our next case for argument, 1-800-CONTACTS, Inc. versus JAND, J-A-N-D, I guess, Inc. And whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stephen Fishbein for the appellant, 1-800-CONTACTS. 1-800-CONTACTS is the leading online retailer of contact lenses in the United States. 1-800-CONTACTS has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in marketing, promotion, and customer service. That investment, which the trademark law and policy encourages, has resulted in millions of customers using 1-800's trademarks to search the internet for 1-800-CONTACTS website. The crux of this case is that when consumers use the marks to find the website, they're expecting to find the website, Warby Parker has hijacked that consumer interest in 1-800-CONTACTS by paying Google to insert its own ad instead of the 1-800 website, which is what the consumers are expecting. Now, contrary to the district court's finding below.
One thing I was unsure about is this is, I guess, referred to as an initial interest confusion claim.
That's part of our claim.
Part of it. Well, that's correct. What I'm trying to find out.
Okay.
What is the claim? I mean, in looking at the claim, am I comparing the two websites and deciding whether they are confusing or likely confusing? So, or to what extent does this initial interest confusion come into play? Am I comparing 1-800-CONTACTS to Warby, or am I comparing 1-800-CONTACTS to 1-800-CONTACTS? I'm a little unsure.
Okay, yeah. I understand, Your Honor.
Yeah.
There are several types of confusion. We allege source confusion, meaning confusion as to who you're buying it from, and also confusion as to affiliation or sponsorship, which means is a confusion as to whether Warby is somehow associated with 1-800-CONTACTS. That's the type of confusion. There's a separate issue as to temporally when in time the confusion occurs. And we allege both that there's initial interest confusion, which is actionable whether or not at the end of the purchase cycle the consumer actually understands where they're purchasing from. So from a timing basis, it's initial interest confusion and point of sale
confusion.
And
you're saying the initial interest confusion is enough in itself?
Yes.
To support an infringement claim?
Yes.
But does this, I'm sorry, just to jump, follow up on that. So your view is, because I have questions about this, the timing portion of this as well, if in fact the websites that we concluded they were not at all, there's no confusion from that, does your claim fail if that happens? Or I mean, I understand you're saying, or I think what you're saying is that there's, the problem or the initial confusion starts perhaps with the keyword search, and then the ad comes up.
Correct.
And then goes to the homepage. But if we disagree on the similarity or confusion as to the website, the homepages, do you still have an argument?
Yes, we do. And, this circuit pioneered and basically established and described this initial interest theory in the Steinway case from the 70s and the Mobil Oil case from the 80s. And I just want to emphasize that in both of those cases, there were facts, and the defendants argued very, very strongly that by the time of purchase, the consumer would absolutely know who they were purchasing from. So like in Mobil Oil, these are contracts worth millions of dollars, oil trading contracts. And there was evidence that when you actually sign the contract, Mobil does not require a letter of credit, but this upstart defendant did. And so based on the paperwork, people would naturally understand that. The district court said, I understand that, but the harm is done if you attract interest and consideration of the consumer based on confusion as to a trademark. And this circuit affirmed, and it's the same exact reasoning in the Steinway case.
I have a little difficulty, though, with applying. I mean, those are useful concepts, but, that's the 70s and the 80s, and we're now talking about a very different world with internet search and with search engines, whereby the regulatory authorities, the FTC and what have you, allow search word auctions and use of trademark in that way, even though it's in commerce, and you could take a different position that you can't have the non-trademark holder purchase the rights to have that response to a search engine. And I gather, it's somewhat more complicated than that because general retailers, you know, Macy's wants to be able to say we're selling Reebok sneakers or what have you. And so understandings have developed. But the rule is that they can conduct these auctions and allow competitors to purchase the keyword search rights to position on the initial response page. So isn't your quarrel kind of with that regime rather than with Warby Parker in particular?
Your Honor, I have to disagree that there's any legal regime. Certainly the FTC in no way, shape, or form has ever said you're allowed to bid on other people's trademarks with abandon. And there's many cases where it's been found to be trademark infringement depending on the circumstances.
But there aren't enforcement actions. I mean, there's no rule that's been promulgated saying you can't that the search engines can't conduct these auctions, right?
There hasn't been a rule saying that you can't. There hasn't been a rule saying that you can, and it comes down to all the circumstances.
It's been happening for a decade, right?
And there's been lawsuits, and 1-800 and other companies have brought lawsuits, and they've been successful in many cases. And in fact, in this court's decision in 1-800 Contacts versus the FTC's position was that these lawsuits are by their nature meritless, and so that settlements are necessarily an antitrust violation. And this court said no, that this is fair grounds for litigation. And depending on all the circumstances, there can be trademark infringement.
Well, and what about the fact that the sponsored results are identified as ad, sponsored, until you get down to the organic results, whatever they're
called. As of the time of our complaint, and if you look at the if you look at the snapshots, it doesn't say sponsored, it says ad, and so that's what we were dealing with then. The ad is in very, very small type. And look, 1-800 does ads too. And so if I'm a consumer and I type in 1-800.com, I am looking to go to that website. It's not shocking that I see ads, and I sort of expecting 1-800 contacts. I see an ad that says 20% off contacts, and I click on it. And the fact that it's an ad doesn't dispel confusion because 1-800 Contacts has ads too.
But when you do click on this, at the top of the page it says Warby Parker.
It does. It's very interesting. There's no dispute that their landing page is different for the people that come in searching for 1-800 Contacts versus searching for Warby Parker. No dispute about that. And there's also no dispute.
But if both are labeled Warby Parker, why does that make a difference?
But why have two different landing pages for the exact same thing and have a separate one only for the people coming in from 1-800 Contacts that looks more like the 1-800 Contacts site?
But what's the real likelihood of confusion if it's adequately labeled that it's Warby Parker?
This is on a motion for judgment on the pleadings, so there's no fact discovery. You know, this is supposed to be taking all the inferences in favor of the plaintiff. We have a strong mark. We have the direct competitors, the exact same product, and consumers, we allege in the complaint that when they search for 1-800 Contacts, that is navigational. They are looking for a specific site, not information about contact lenses. And there's a lot of empirical research to support that. So given their expectations, given what they're expecting, Judge Chin, you asked, should we just compare them? That's not the context. The context is the consumer who's already decided, I want to go to 1-800-Contacts.com.
The confusion is, so, and I tried this last night, you know, I Google 1-800-Contact, and the first thing that shows up, it's a little bit different now, it says sponsor.
Yeah.
But it's Warby Parker.
Correct.
Is the confusion that that a consumer might believe that she is in the 1-800 website?
The confusion is that having looked for, let's take somebody that searches for 1-800.com. That is the only way a consumer can go find the website because they don't have brick and mortar stores. The way you go to 1-800-Contacts is to put in 1-800.com. And so they do that and they're expecting to see results of what they look for, 1-800.com. They see an ad that says 20% off contacts. Yes, they click on it thinking that it's 1-800-Contacts. Now they get to this special website that's different than the one that Warby Parker usually uses, that is certainly similar in some ways to 1-800-Contacts.
But if it's labeled Warby Parker,
but Your Honor,
why does it matter? Go ahead.
Because, and that's the initial interest confusion, okay? So, like, for example, in the Steinway case, they made the same argument. And what this circuit said is the very fact that you have now taken the consumer's time and attention and focused on a product usurping the goodwill of the original trademark owner, that's actionable. And what I would say to you is, okay, so maybe they go to the Warby site and they look around and they say, hey, this is pretty cheap, this is okay, and they purchase, and maybe by the time of purchase, they do recognize it's Warby Parker. But they wouldn't have gotten there, and they wouldn't have given their time and attention without the initial confusion of the initial ad.
So this isn't in the record, I don't think, but so if I search Warby Parker, has 1-800-CONTACTS bought ads so that 1-800-CONTACTS also shows as a response?
No, 1-800-CONTACTS is not in that business. They've been on the other side of that issue. We've brought a number of lawsuits, and my time is up, but Judge, you had mentioned that this is different from Steinway's in 1975, but it's different in a lot of ways, and the value of eyeballs on the internet and what they call clicks is absolutely enormous. I mean, Google makes billions and billions of dollars a year, and it's all based on where the consumer clicks when they do a search. That is what's extremely valuable, because everybody recognizes once you get the click, once they click on your website and you've drawn them in and they're considering your offering, they're likely to purchase. And that's where the confusion is. When somebody is expecting, which we allege, as a matter of fact, we allege that if you search for that, you're expecting 1-800-CONTACTS, and they get this other thing and it's not clearly distinguished, there's confusion.
And is that necessarily so in a day where people have been buying on the internet, especially after the pandemic, all the time?
Yeah.
And so we have consumers who are not befuddled. They're used to doing all their acquisitions on the internet. Why are they going to be likely confused?
So we have some consumers who are befuddled, who are not befuddled, but we have some consumers who are. And I'll end with, I think in this case, the district court's findings on that issue, on consumer sophistication, are particularly troublesome and inappropriate, because the internet, I mean, it's constantly changing. It's completely dynamic. As Judge Chin pointed out, just the way they label ads changes. It's multifaceted. You've got organic results. You've got ad results. And the experience of consumers varies dramatically based on age. I mean, my children have a very, very different experience than I do, trust me. Profession, whether you deal with the internet in your profession, education, technical ability, all those things. And that is why this is a fact question. And a particular judge, whatever experience he or she brings to it with their background, Judge Castell obviously felt that, yeah, like if it says Warby in the URL, people will notice that. But it is not for the judge to substitute their armchair impression for what is really evidence on this, which
has to do with the plausibility
surveys, testimony, examples of actual confusion, which we would get in discovery. And this is exactly the situation where a lay jury chosen by the parties with diverse perspectives should weigh in on these extremely important issues of what is the consumer experience on the internet. I do not think that's a foregone conclusion, and it's certainly not judicial notice. I mean, judicial notice is Monday, June 12th was a Monday, or what time did the sun set? This is hotly, hotly debated question of what the consumer's reaction would be when they expect 1-800-CONTACTS, because that's what they search for, and they get this other ad that doesn't say we're not 1-800-CONTACTS.
And forgive me, I may have just forgotten, but does your complaint include any proffer of an expert who has done surveys reflecting the confusion that a jury might find?
At the complaint stage, but we have evidence of bad faith. And of course, if we're able to prove bad faith, then actual confusion would be presumed. And we certainly allege that consumers.
But you have no factual basis, particularly for the allegation that people are in fact confused.
Well, I think the allegation that there was a deliberate effort to set up a separate page, which they are paying a lot of money to get that first position. And I think the fair inference is that they're doing that and they set up the separate page because it works, because they are siphoning off our customers.
Okay.
So that is what we play. Thank you.
Thank you.
And may it please the court, Roxanne Ealings with Davis Wright Tremaine for Appellee, Jand Inc., DBA, Warby Parker. Virtually no court has held that on its own a defendant's purchase of a plaintiff's mark as a keyword term is sufficient for liability. Trademark infringement must take into account the practicality of the real world. And in the context of internet AdWords, the practicalities of the commercial world is that an appreciable number of consumers are not likely to be confused. And that's key, appreciable
is
number.
Is that a factual question, whether an appreciable number of consumers would be confused here? And how do we deal with it at the pleading stage?
Well, I believe at the pleading stage, there are other courts that have similarly held where the defendant's advertisement is labeled as an ad. Defendant's advertisement contains the defendant's
the complaint,
own.
I'm looking at paragraph 12 of the complaint. It alleges that once customers reach the Warby Parker page, some customers are confused.
So I believe that's a conclusory allegation. The decision here is in line with
factual allegation. Some customers are confused.
Well, an appreciable number of consumers are confused, but when you look at the other allegations, including the websites, the fact that, as I said before, labeled ad doesn't have the Warby Parker and Warby Parker.
Was
the
district
website.
Court making a finding of fact when it concluded that these days consumers are so sophisticated and know the internet so well that they are not likely to be confused, or that not an appreciable number would be confused? Is that not a finding of fact?
Well, I believe in the context of all of the allegations here, even if that were a finding of fact, which I do not believe it is.
You don't think that's a finding of fact?
Given the context here, I would say, and I guess I want to go back to the context, is that you've got Warby Parker at the top of the web page, right? And Warby Parker in the ad itself. Nowhere does 800 contacts show up except as an AdWord, which is legal in this day and age. The Tenth Circuit, in a case involving...
I mean, the current one, when I did it last night, it was pretty clear that it was Warby Parker. When I look at the one in the complaint, it's much harder to see Warby Parker. The words are much smaller. And then I suppose there's also the argument that maybe Warby Parker is associated with 1-800.
There's nothing in the allegations that – there's nothing that alleges that they are associated. What would make someone –
Well, they're not alleging that they are associated. They're alleging that people might think they are associated.
Right. My point is there's no factual allegations that support that legal conclusion. So the Tenth Circuit, in a case involving appellant here, affirmed summary dismissal of a claim of infringement in the similar circumstances in 800 Context versus Lens.com, where plaintiff's marks did not appear in the keyword advertisement. So at the pleading stage, again, where there it's labeled an ad, it has the defendant's name in the link, and the website has defendant's name clearly labeled above, it virtually no court has held, and many have held at this stage they've held judgment on the pleadings. So, for example, the Southern District has done so in Alzheimer's. I would also just note that the idea of initial interest confusion, the Second Circuit has specifically recognized that even if a plaintiff's potential customers are diverted by keyword advertising to defendant's competing website, the customer can quickly become aware of the competing source's actual identity and rectify the mistake. And that's diversion, not confusion. It's Kid Car versus Kid Moto in the Southern District also cited Savin for that.
Your adversary points to our cases from the 70s and 80s involving Steinway and Mobil, and says it doesn't matter if at the end of the day the purchaser knows that the actual provider is not what they initially thought. How do you distinguish those cases?
So, and I can't recall the case that distinguishes this, but it's sort of like going down a highway. You see a sign that says, you know, defendants off, you know, off this ramp. You drive off, or plaintiffs off this ramp. You drive off. You drive miles to get there. It's the plaintiff, and it's a different world. As you said, it's not the 70s, the 80s. It's the world of the internet, and it, if anything, it's diversion and not confusion.
Is your view, though, that, and it may not be, that this initial interest confusion theory has no application to these types of searches, or?
It only if there is intent, there may be. So the types of websites, for example, where there has been found to be infringement or confusion is where, for example, you click on a site and somehow you tie into a call center, or where the ad is not clearly labeled, and then you go to the site and it has plaintiffs.
Well, their position here is, I think, part of what they're relying on is that the district court's saying there's some basis for finding bad faith given the distinct website that you are landed to when you click on one of these ads, that this Warby Parker page is different than if you just put in Warby Parker contacts, and that's at least suggests some bad faith. What's your...
Right, and the court took note of that, the allegations of that, that it noted some bad faith, but bad faith doesn't equal likelihood of confusion. And trademark infringement, the core of it is whether consumers are confused. So you might even have someone acting in bad faith, but they haven't confused the consumer, even assuming that, right? So in the cases...
But does that go to, I mean, I think earlier you said that you weren't rejecting that the initial interest confusion is, you're not saying that that's no longer valid, but that it can be valid in this type of context when combined with intent, deceptive or what have you.
But the type of intent that is found in the other cases is where, like, for example, CJ Products versus Snuggly, where the defendant changed their website to Pillow Pets, which was the trademark of the plaintiff, and then used Pillow Pets on their website itself. Another one is Adler out of the Fifth Circuit, where they use generic ads.
What about the Select Comfort case out of the Eighth Circuit? Seems pretty similar. The complaint was dismissed. The Eighth Circuit vacated and remanded, holding that a jury question existed as to the issue of consumer sophistication, and therefore a plaintiff should not be barred from proving pre-sale initial interest confusion.
So in that case, again, what was alleged is there were actually fraudulent misrepresentations and failing to dispel the confusion. So those are much stronger facts, or those were facts that went to that for Select Comfort. And they contacted defendants' call centers. And then
what about the issue of whether the district court made factual findings? For example, the district court said that even assuming some consumers will mistakenly click on a Warby Parker search the ad, these consumers would then take time to meaningfully review the contents and layout of the website before taking any further action. Isn't that a factual finding? And if so, is that appropriate on a 12C motion?
I think on these contacts, I think you can even find it without that. You can even find a judgment on the pleadings without that. But here, 800 contacts, consumers were alleged to be those who buy contact lenses online. There are many cases, even ones that dismiss at this level, that once you have the other that I said, right? No trademark. You hit Warby Parker's website and you see their trademark. that there is no confusion, because it has to be, it just doesn't support the kind of confusion that he, that I believe his allegation is conclusory in that. And so while trademark infringement may have some fact-intensive issues, it doesn't mean that it can never be decided at the pleadings level.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Eelings, is it?
Yes, thank you.
So briefly, my colleague began by saying that there are no decisions establishing liability under certain circumstances. Again, this is not about liability. This is about whether we have pled enough to get discovery. And RescueCom is an internet case on AdWords that at the end of the decision makes very clear that whether it's a benign practice or not, all these issues we've been discussing, is a fact question for discovery. My adversary cited the Alzheimer's case. That was a bench trial where the judge heard surveys and testimony. That's what we want the opportunity. They can make their case that we haven't proved it, but we get the opportunity to try. And with respect to sophistication, every case they cited in their brief for the proposition that judges...
I'm sorry, the Alzheimer's case included a logo that was very familiar, seemed to have been stolen from one and used by the other. So there was a presentation issue that I think isn't here. This is about ad positioning and how the search engine auction works.
They were different contexts, that's right. But my point is that to make an argument based on Alzheimer's where there's a full factual record isn't quite fair, because we haven't had the opportunity to do that. When we take discovery of
what I'm saying is that they were able to plead at the very beginning that there was an unfair and bad faith usage of the marks because of the visual similarity of the marks that were adopted. So it was well beyond the ad auction situation where the hit page or the landing page was actually labeled correctly.
So that's a difference, but we have alleged bad faith as well, and the judge found that there was evidence of it. So I think in this case, again, with the two landing pages for the same exact thing that are different, with no explanation as to why you would go through the time and effort of creating a special landing page for people that clicked on the link based on a search for 1-800-CONTACTS, that's bad faith. And look, the Polaroid factors list bad faith as one of several factors. It is not a requirement for initial interest confusion that we show bad faith. We've alleged it, but it's a series of factors. And I'll just end by saying I think it would be extraordinary in a case like this where it's not disputed that it's a very strong mark. We are direct competitors. It is exactly the same product. When you get a contact lens prescription, the prescription says the manufacturer and the measurements. So if you buy it from 1-800-CONTACTS, you buy it from Orbi, it is exactly the same thing. So direct competitors, same product, strong mark, bad faith, and we can't even get to discovery, I think that would be extraordinary. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fishbein. Thank you both. We will take this case under advisement as well. And we have two other cases that are on for submission, so that concludes our argument calendar for this morning. So I think we are ready to adjourn.
Court stands adjourned. Thank you.